Hi, welcome to another edition of the PCRF podcast. My name is Dave Page, and I'm here with
Dr. Keith Wesley, Medical Director for Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Marshall Washick, Paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation.
Dr. Aaron Burnett, I'm an Emergency Physician and Pre-Hospital Medicine Fellow with Regents Hospital.
And we're lucky to be reviewing today what we're in the Twin Cities calling the Rescue Trial, but I will read the formal and long title that it will appear in the Lancet in December. It's in press currently in that journal. And the long title is it's Competitive Effectiveness of Standard CPR versus Active Compression Decompression CPR with Augmentation of Negative Intrathoracic Pressure for Treatment of Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. Results from a randomized prospective study. The principal investigator is Dr. Tom Ofterheide, and he is accompanied by Dr. Frasconi and Dr. Wayne, Dr. Mahoney, Dr. Swore. And we're lucky to have Dr. Lurie here, who is the inventor of the rescue pod and the rescue pump or cardio pump. And Dr. Lurie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Keith Lurie. I am a cardiac electrophysiologist. I practice in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and I'm also a professor of emergency medicine and internal medicine at the University of Minnesota. And about 20 years ago, we had a discovery at the University of Minnesota, and that involved discovering the concept of the impedance threshold device. In animals, the combination of the impedance threshold device and active compression decompression CPR resulted in about four times the blood flow that we observe with standard CPR. And to make a long story short, since the university and no companies wanted to develop this, but we thought it might save lives, we started a company back in 1997 called Advanced Circulatory Systems. And the study that we're going to talk about today is a study that stems from that initial discovery at the University of Minnesota. And it was a study that was funded by the National Institute of Health.
Excellent. And just to declare conflicts, you clearly have a conflict, but I don't think any of us have any stock in the situation, so we're conflict-free. We definitely want to begin with just a description of how this trial occurred. And it's rare to see a randomized, controlled, prospective trial in pre-hospital care. That is just rare. And this particular study is a landmark study because it is, I believe, the first study to look at a device during resuscitation. The findings were presented at the Resuscitation Science Symposium at the American Heart Association here in Chicago. So very, very rare that we have a look at a device in CPR that followed patients for up to 1 year after discharge from the hospital. So it wasn't just survival, it wasn't just return of pulse to the ER, it wasn't just survival to discharge, but it was good neurological outcomes, CPC scores, for 1 year, and that really is rare. So let's explain kind of how this worked. The trial looked at, it's an NIH-funded trial, and we looked at, or the authors looked at, compression, decompression CPR, so the use of a handheld plunger-like device to pull up on the chest in combination with an impedance threshold device. So in this case, the rescue pod attached to either a mask or an endotracheal tube. The participants of the study were obviously cardiac arrest patients, medical cardiac arrest patients, and it was randomized by blocks of weeks. So obviously generated from a random number generator, the crews would receive the devices, and when the week that it was their turn to do CPR, I think they called it the pump and pod days. They did pump and pod, and then when it was time for them not to do it, those devices were removed from the stations and not available to them. Is that good? Does that kind of summarize the methodology, Dr. Lurie?
That's correct. We went to seven U.S. sites across the country that had had some experience previously with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and patients were randomized if they had a cardiac arrest of cardiac etiology to either a pair of hands, standard CPR, or this combination of active compression decompression or ACD CPR with a plunger-like device and the impedance threshold device. And we comprehensively trained everybody basically every 6 months. So they were performing excellent standard CPR and excellent CPR with a device combination.
Tell us what your results were.
So over the course of this five-year study, a total of 2,470 patients were actually randomized to one method of CPR or the other. And of those 2,470 patients, about 1,650 actually were found to have a cardiac arrest of cardiac etiology. Others had trauma, or they had a pulmonary emboli or electrocution and that sort of thing. So they were not considered as part of the primary study population. In the primary study population, there were about 820 in each arm. And what we observed is that at the time of hospital discharge, there were 53% more patients in the device group that survived a hospital discharge with good neurologic function compared to the control group. And that difference of about 50% was observed up to 1 year, which was the time that we stopped the follow-up. We also observed that at the time of 1 year, there were very few people who had poor neurologic function, and the neurologic function in both the control patients with standard CPR and those that received the device combination was excellent.
So a 2 times more likelihood of survival to discharge with good neurological outcomes?
50%.
50%.
Correct. Relative 50% increase.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the limitations of the study, and then we'll open it up to discussion from the whole group. Tell us sort of what were some of the difficulties.
Well, I think that what I'd like to perhaps focus on a little bit first are a few more of the findings. I've shared with you the overall finding, but I want to look at a couple of the rhythm issues and some of the subgroups, and we can talk about some of the limitations if that's okay.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So what we observed is that if you had a witnessed arrest, no surprise, you did better, but you did actually significantly better with the device group. If you were a male, you had better survival rates than women overall in both groups, at least 50% greater likelihood of survival to hospital discharge with good neurologic function, whether you were in the control group or the device group if you were a male. And the males did better yet with the devices. One of the striking findings, especially for somebody who's in their 50s, is
yes,
that,
I was just going to say it's
is that the device group was found to be a benefit across all age groups, but in the age bracket of 50 to 60, there are actually twice as many survivors in the device group.
So it really, really works with that particular population.
Well, I think that it works with all populations, but that was a population that had a higher likelihood of being able to come back. We observed a range of neurologic findings at the time of hospital discharge, but actually twice as many patients had a normal neurologic function as measured by something called the modified Rankin scale with a 0 or 1. There were 22 patients in the device group versus 11 patients in the control group that had a 0 or 1 for a modified Rankin scale. So what we observed was actually a lot of consistency across the study. If you look from the time the study was started to the four-year point where we stopped a new patient enrollment, it would look like two almost straight lines across a piece of paper in terms of the consistent difference between the study groups. So we had consistency in the time of enrollment, across sites, across age, across gender. So we're pretty excited about that from the perspective of the validity of the study. In terms of the limitations, of course, there are always limitations. We couldn't blind the study. Some people have said, "How come you didn't blind it?" Well, My response is that we have a pair of hands,
and then we have some tools.
Exactly, we have a pair of hands and some tools. So we've gone from sort of being at the caveman level with a pair of hands to some tools. So it's hard to blind that. But what we did do is we blinded everything after the patient arrived to the hospital. So all the neurologic assessments were blinded. The clinical
meaning
events
that
committee.
The nurses that were making the follow-up phone calls didn't know if this was a patient that had the device or not.
That's correct.
Downstream is usually what people say, and nobody knew whether this was a patient that that had had the intervention or not.
That's correct. And of course, there are some people who may criticize me because I'm an inventor and we wanted to do this study. But in fact, we had nothing to do with the neurologic assessment of the patients, the care of the patients, the CPR provided to the patients, the data safety monitoring board that determined whether or not we should continue the study or not was blinded, the clinical events committee that looked at every case to determine whether or not they qualified as a patient that met the full criteria, in other words, the right age, whether or not the patient had a traumatic or non-traumatic arrest, that sort of thing. That was all
blinded. And for would-be researchers, this is about the Cadillac of research. You're funded by the National Institute of Health. So NIH and the federal government looks very carefully into how they're going to spend those dollars. You had to get FDA approval for devices and experimental devices.
Yeah, this is actually the first study done under a 1996 federal regulation for CPR devices that will go through the FDA as part of this waiver of informed consent. So for those who are interested in research in this space, it is actually a very rigorous process, but we now have a process. But it's also one of the limitations. So perhaps the biggest limitation of the study surrounds this issue of informed consent. Because we cannot get informed consent at the time that we deliver CPR, we have to go through what's called a waiver of consent process, which means that we need to inform the community that we're going to do the study.
So newspapers and television ads, et cetera.
Correct. Then we have to hold community meetings with representatives from all different walks of life in the community. Then we have to go through the institutional review boards, or IRBs, at all of the local hospitals that were receiving the patients. And then throughout the study, we had to maintain very rigorous and very meticulous records related to the training of anybody who had these devices, where the devices were used, and of course, everything related to adverse events, et cetera.
And in this case, you had to train 4,000 plus providers. So when that translates to actual boots on the ground, rubber meets the road, that's a lot of people to get trained into the performance of that particular type of CPR.
That's correct. We had to train actually nearly 5,000 first responders, 4,940
4,940. Incredible.
So, but the limitation related to informed consent is a curious one, because while we can perform CPR, we cannot report the results unless we get consent from the family or the patient. And that also takes time. So as a result of the informed consent piece, we were missing data on 17 patients who survived, we know, or we think survived a hospital discharge. It turns out that about 14 of those patients survived a hospital discharge, and most of them did very poorly, and the families didn't want us to, you know, find out or include them or even talk to them, because it's hard to get informed consent from a family who is grieving. So this is a very challenging issue, and we had to approach the family and explain that, or the individual sites would approach the family and say that they were representing the EMS system and they're involved with a national NIH study, and we wanted to ask for the family to let us review the medical record of the patient. And if they said no, then we could not include the patient from that point forward.
So let me ask you about another limitation, because you were studying two devices instead of one. So the intervention arm is actually looking not just at the ITD, but the combination of the ITD and the pump. So for critics out there who would say, why'd you look at two things at once? How would you answer that?
I think that's an excellent question. This was a study that was designed to be a so-called pivotal study so that we could do one definitive study and get FDA approval. But prior to this pivotal study, there were five earlier clinical trials, as well as a number of animal studies. So I mentioned early on that in pigs, we saw four times the blood flow to the heart and the brain with this device combination compared to standard CPR. The first study in humans was actually a hemodynamic study in Paris, France. They had already been using the cardiopump or active compression decompression CPR device, and in a randomized double-blinded trial, they compared a sham versus active impedance threshold device, and they observed a striking increase in end-tidal CO2 and coronary perfusion pressure and systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure. In fact, the blood pressure in the patients who received the devices was about 110 over about 55.
So you had some evidence that the ITD doubled perfusion. Did you have evidence that it helped survival to discharge?
So in that particular study, the short-term endpoint was coronary perfusion pressure, but more people actually did have return of spontaneous circulation. In the next study from Paris, they looked at whether or not they could use the device with a face mask. Could they get a good seal, and would we see a decrease in intrathoracic pressure? And that was a very important study because with active compression, decompression CPR alone, or with a pair of hands, when the chest recoils either passively or actively, you do not see a decrease in pressure inside the chest. The only reason you see it with the impedance threshold device is that actually blocks air from rushing into the lungs as the chest is recoiling. And so you can see a nice decrease to about minus 7 or 8 millimeters of mercury. So that was another physiologic study. The next clinical study was a larger study with the primary endpoint in France being 24-hour survival. And there they took 400 patients, double-blinded randomized trial, 200 got a sham device, 200 got an active device, and they all received ACD CPR because that's what they used at the time in France. And what they observed was a greater than 50% increase in 24-hour survival rates in the active device patient population. More patients got to hospital discharge, and the p-value for improved neurologic function in hospital discharge was 0.07. So it wasn't the primary endpoint, but it was close. And then almost concurrently in Mainz, Germany, there was another study that was designed very similar to the one we just completed here that we're talking about today. And they compared patients who received standard CPR prospectively with block randomization to those receiving the device combination. And again, saw about a 50% increase in 24-hour survival rates and very close to a statistically significant difference in neurologically intact hospital discharge rates. So we knew we were close. What changed between then and now in Germany and in the United States is as a result of the studies with the impedance threshold device in Milwaukee, we figured out that we had all kinds of problems with the quality of CPR, and we actually, as we know, were able to make the quality of CPR and overall CPR better by giving fewer ventilations and more chest compressions per minute.
And for people who aren't familiar with those studies, Dr. Ofterheide, who's the principal investigator in this study, had done a great job of sort of finally getting at the hyperventilation issue, at the overventilation issue, and really exposing sort of the lack of quality in CPR. Let's open it up to commentary questions from the rest of the folks here.
Yeah, the first question I'd have for you, Dr. Lohr, is with that issue of quality of CPR and hyperventilation, how did you control for that in seven different sites? Were they using, when they were using the rescue pump, there's a metronome for controlling rate and compression depth, but how about ventilatory rate? I'm assuming, of course, with the pod, you've got the lights that controls that. But then, so what about for the manual standard CPR? How do we know were they just doing piss poor manual CPR?
So I think that's a fair question. We decided we would compare a very high quality standard CPR to the device combination since we'd already shown in an extremely well-controlled setting in animals that the physiology was as we believe it is, that you can harness the chest wall recoil and move more blood back to the heart and lower intracranial pressure as the chest recoils and you don't allow air to rush into the lungs. And that combination quadrupled blood flow to the heart and the brain. So then when we go out on the streets, the question was, should we arm the control group with tools that they don't use routinely, or should we train them well? And we elected to train them well. So when I mentioned before we had comprehensive training, all of the 940 first responders had to go through a training curricular where, in addition to reading about the study and reading about the devices, they had to demonstrate to the principal investigator or the lead paramedics at the sites that they were competent and able to perform both standard CPR as well as CPR with a study intervention. And they did that every 6 months. What was striking to us is how well, in fact, they performed standard CPR. And the survival rate in the standard CPR group at the end of the study rivaled that in the best cities across the country. So to give you an overall sort of estimate, at the time of hospital discharge, all patients had a 9.9% survival rate in the control group. Now, that translated...
That's the standard CPR group.
That's correct. That translated to a 6% or thereabouts hospital discharge rate with good neurologic function. But to have that high a standard CPR control group speaks to how high the quality of standard CPR was. They had feedback from lead paramedics who were required to go out twice a month to codes and give feedback to the first responders. That was a job, a task to the site investigator, usually an EMS medical director or one of their sort of lieutenants. So that was a very important issue for us, and we think that, if anything, you know, we may have overtrained them, but that was our intent. In fact, we wanted to make sure that indeed it was a study intervention or device effect rather than sort of the Hawthorne effect, as it were.
So, Dr. Lee, I got a question, too. With all the CPR research, the resuscitation research we're seeing, the farther downrange we can get these devices, the better the patients do. We saw that with defibrillators, getting them from the hospital to the ambulance, to the public access defibrillators in the airports and the golf courses. With these devices you studied, how much extra training is it going to take for someone to use them correctly? Is it going to be something that's limited to professional rescuers in an ambulance? Or do you think someday we'll be able to get these even farther downrange and have them maybe next to the defibrillator at the golf course in the airport?
The combination of the two devices requires somebody to be able to do chest compressions with a handheld device, which is quite intuitive and very easy to learn how to use. Similarly, the ITD or rescue pod is very easy to put on a face mask, but people have to be taught to maintain a high-quality seal throughout the entire resuscitation effort, and we teach to have one person put two hands on the face mask and maintain that seal, because if you don't have a vacuum, then you can't get any real benefit from the rescue pod. At the current time, it's difficult to teach lay rescuers, if they were to pick up a face mask at the airport with an AED and a rescue pod attached to it, it's difficult sort of out of the box without training, I think, to teach them how to do high-quality ventilation with the rescue pod. Not impossible, but over time, as this technology becomes more and more part of the routine, we think we will see this combination next to AEDs. Clearly, we can teach people how to do active compression, decompression, CPR. The NIH gave us a large grant to develop a easier-to-use manual active compression, decompression, CPR device, which we hope to test soon in Kalamazoo, Michigan. But I don't think the combination is ready at this point in time. But what I can say is that if we follow the latest AHA guidelines, which is to have lay rescuers start good chest compressions, and if they know how to ventilate, do so, that we believe that that's going to be a way that people can buy time until professionals can arrive and they can do this device combination, and we can see a significant improvement in lives saved.
So can I be crass and just say, grab the plunger? Can we recommend now that people at home reach for the bathroom first and do compressions with a plunger, or is it just too early to say that?
Well, I wouldn't say that. In fact, I would say grab your phone, call 911, and start doing some good chest compressions.
Oh, that's a politically correct answer. Good job.
So, but you need to know that when I was the attending on the man who was resuscitated by a toilet plunger in 1987 at San Francisco General Hospital, his family did grab the plunger. This family from Iran did not know standard CPR, and they had grabbed the plunger on two prior events, and so they grabbed the plunger the night before and plunged Dad's chest. And the 20-year-old son said to me, "Hey, Doc, you need to get a plunger at the end of every one of these CCU beds." So, David, I think your comment was both funny and perhaps appropriate, but it's actually probably more effective, at least as we know it today, to start chest compressions right away than to sort of go into some room where there may or may not be a plunger.
So, go ahead.
Let me have you just address a couple of other issues in the study that, you know, were... because there's other, you know, other studies of similar magnitude, the ROC study that came out, which certainly had some systematic issues and implementation issues and the inability to control for various co-founding elements. And the first thing I always look at when I look at a study such as yours is to go, well, so what happened else in those seven systems during the study time? What was the change in their protocols as it relates to pre-hospital hypothermia, the prevalence of hospital hypothermia, and the prevalence of taking these patients post-ROSC to the cath lab for catheterization and defibrillator implantation? And because you can't stop a hospital's and a program's system improvements while you're doing a multi-year study. And so did you see an effect with any of those?
So yes, this gives us an opportunity to talk about some of the care that was provided during the study and also perhaps to compare our study a little bit to the ROC study. So I think it's important to say that during the study, we asked the sites not to use pre-hospital cooling and not to use vasopressin, and they complied. We encouraged the sites to use hypothermia once patients were admitted to the hospital if they met the criteria which were used locally. And eventually over the course of the study, because the study started in 2005 at the old guidelines and then sort of ended in 2010, in fact, in July, that was the last follow-up. So in terms of therapeutic hypothermia, we encouraged them to use it. About 40% of the patients in both groups were treated with therapeutic hypothermia. That leaves us 60% of the patients who were not. We have really high-quality records on the survivors in terms of whether or not they were cooled or not. And I can tell you, if you did not get cooling, you did twice as well. We had twice the number of people who were discharged with good neurologic function by the time they got to hospital discharge in the device group. So what we observed, very interestingly, was that if you got cooled, both groups did better, but the standard CPR group benefited more than the device group. And we think that's because the device group is neuroprotective. They received a neuroprotective effect all by itself. I mentioned earlier that one of the sort of the magic sauce of this device combination, as it were, is not just greater blood flow out of the heart, but when we achieve that intrathoracic vacuum, when we pull up with the suction cup device and block air from rushing into the lungs, then intracranial pressure actually goes down lower and faster, which means there's less resistance to forward blood flow. And we think that that combination of a sort of a double effect on the brain resulted in a neuroprotective effect. What we also know is that more patients, although not statistically so, it was close, were stable enough in the hospital to undergo cardiac catheterization and bypass surgery in the device group than in the control group. In other words, when the cardiologist came around and said, "How's this patient doing? Should we take this patient to the cath lab?" More patients went to the cath lab in the device group. Now, in terms of the ROCK study, which was occurring simultaneously. This is another NIH multi-site study. This was a very complex study. They actually tried to address two questions simultaneously. Does 30 seconds of CPR make a difference compared to 3 minutes of CPR? And then did an active ITD make a difference compared to a sham ITD? And when we agreed to allow the NIH to study that, we thought we were just going to get an active versus sham ITD study. And they surprised us with this other study, which they overlaid on top, which meant that most patients got 30 seconds of CPR analyzed shock or 3 minutes of CPR analyzed shock before the ITD was placed. So in the ROCK study, or Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium study, the ITD was placed on average 10 minutes after EMS was dispatched, versus in the rescue trial study, or the study with the device combination, the devices were used on average at 7.5 minutes or earlier. What we do know from both studies is time is of the essence. So we looked at the impact of what happens if you put the device on within 5 minutes or less in the rescue trial. And what we observed was that we had a very large difference between the control group and the device group. And the overall effectiveness of both methods of CPR was much better if CPR was started within 5 minutes of 911 call than from 5 to 10 minutes. And we had no survivors with good neurologic function if the devices were put on after 10 minutes. By contrast, in the ROCK study, if you had VF and a witnessed arrest, and you had the device put on within 5 minutes, and your arrest was in public, you had a 33% likelihood, actually a 32.9% likelihood of surviving with a sham device versus a 39.2% likelihood of surviving with an active device. So from my perspective, both studies are actually quite consistent. The challenge is getting the devices on quickly. And we asked one question in our study that we've been talking about today, and the ROCK study asked a couple questions, which confounded things.
And I think it is important to talk about, we're going to stick to our conversation about the rescue trial, and we can, I think it'd be great to talk about the ROCK trial in a different context. But that whole issue of confounding variables in cardiac arrest research becomes very, very important. And truly, it is important to read the entire paper and wait and dig through all of the information rather than just read the headlines and the abstracts. I think that there's a way in which we tend to sort of hear some of the headlines and don't really dig into some of the other issues, such as what happened when the patients had a return of pulse. Was the rescue pod removed at that point, or did it stay on? Because the recommendation is to remove it, and we don't sometimes know if until we read the full paper to really understand all of the variables that are there.
There are two other aspects of the rescue trial that, if I may, I'd like to talk about, which might be interesting for the audience. Do we have time?
We have just a little bit of time left, and then I have a paramedic level question, in my level question. But go ahead.
Paramedic level question. What do you mean by that?
One syllable words for Dave Page. Actually, the paramedics out there are much smarter. So the Dave Page question, if I may, is I'm just getting back pain thinking off the bat. I'm going to have to pull up on the chest, and I'm thinking, did anybody get hurt in the process doing this particular type of CPR? Because it's very exhausting. It required people to switch very often in order to keep high quality CPR, but was also very effective. So I'm willing to put the oomph into it. And did anybody get hurt?
So that's perfect, because that was one of the two things I wanted to talk about. Nobody got hurt in the study. It does require a little more energy. The crews typically did best if they had three or four firefighters at the crews. This was really a firefighter EMT-based study with paramedics often there as well, but they were sort of directing the show or giving the drugs. Nobody got hurt. But what was quite striking for all of us was that when they were getting CPR, we had some patients who actually woke up. And so that is something that as a medic, you don't often see. People would be moving their arms and legs. They'd be trying to pull the tube.
It is pretty freaky, I have to say.
And in one case, at least one most notable case, in the Oshkosh, Wisconsin site, a 67-year-old engineer had been getting CPR for a couple of minutes, and he opened his eyes and he said, "I think you can stop doing CPR now." And they did, and he was still in VF. And of course, he became comatose immediately again. And he continues to this day, after being resuscitated, to be a professor of engineering and doing very well. And that's one of the most gratifying things, actually, about taking this technology from its infancy to where we are today, to see how well these patients can do. And one of the big fears was always, you're going to have a lot of brain-dead people, just more vegetables. Au contraire, these people actually do really well.
And for the patients that did wake up, did they need to be sedated at any point? Was that part of the study protocol?
It wasn't part of the study protocol, but we had advised all the sites that they might see awakening. And in fact, sedation with benzodiazepines was routinely used in patients who showed some signs of neurologic awakening. We tracked that, actually, and that occurred in about 5% of the patients.
So I was curious before we did this podcast, as I was writing that priority traffic article, and wanted to know if the device was actually available for purchase at this point. And I have found out that in Europe I could buy one, but around here it'd probably be another year before I could get my hands on one of these cardio pumps that that would allow me to pull up on the chest.
That's correct. We performed the study in collaboration, as it were, with the FDA. And so this was done under what's called an investigational device exemption application. We followed everything to the T. The FDA is aware of the results, and we anticipate presenting to a cardiovascular panel as part of what's called a PMA or pre-market approval process sometime in the 2011 timeframe. They have a pretty long and arduous process still, but I'm optimistic that in about a year from the time that this broadcast is being aired, that the device combination will be available in the United States.
So in the meantime, if you're out there doing CPR, possibly ensure that chest recoil is complete, so get your hands off that chest. And make sure that you are doing good quality CPR, that you're using any combination of devices that you can get your hands on, to either metronomes or timing lights, et cetera, that you're not interrupting CPR, because we now know those things to be very, very valuable. And we know, at least from previous studies, that the impedance threshold device in many cases will be very beneficial. So, I'm saying that with no conflicts. So any other parting thoughts?
I just have one quick question, Dr. Lurie. Were all your patients transported, or all the patients in this study transported regardless of rhythm or ROSC in the field? Were you able to monitor CPR throughout the entire patient's
Arrest,
yeah.
So, very good question. Part of the protocol was that the CPR was to be performed at the scene for a minimum of 30 minutes. And the patients who were resuscitated were, with a return of spontaneous circulation, were transported to a hospital that could take care of them in the most appropriate manner. And usually they were hospitals that had cardiac cath labs and full cardiology and ICU care facilities. We actually looked at the duration of CPR in all cases. So in those patients who did not have return of spontaneous circulation, that was the exact same duration in both study arms. We looked at the amount of epinephrine that was given. It was the exact same amount in both study arms if they did not come back. And the reason that we wanted them to be worked in the field is we know how terrible the outcomes are if you work patients in a rig, and we also know that it's dangerous for the people providing CPR. So that may change with some of the automated devices. We have a number of them out there that can be used during transport. But as a clinician, I would still recommend that we try to resuscitate patients for up to 30 minutes in the field. And in those rare cases where somebody has tried to come back, but they're unstable, and so they've rearrested and rearrested, in that case, both in the study and in non-study conditions, I would recommend trying to bring them in. And if you have an automated CPR device that can provide excellent compressions and good chest wall recoil, to use that as well.
Thank you, Dr. Lurie, for a wonderful podcast, but also just congratulations on years of study of this issue, and not just in this particular rescue trial, but having to take your research to Europe and still at it, still getting those projects completed. So congratulations.
Well, thank you, David. And as you know, we actually feel like this is just the beginning. And we're doing some pretty exciting things in animals with this kind of device combination and new drugs. And I hope in a future time to be able to share that with this group.
Excellent. Thank you for tuning into this podcast. And thanks to our technical editors, FizDap, for their support.